Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, Episode 170, Interview with Brian Thomas Schmidt. This episode is brought to you by Wolf Dawn, the new science fiction novel, who some people call controversial, by Susan Cartwright, and by Majesty's Offspring, by A.J. Vega, for all of you technological singularity fans out there.
It's basically about the business of writing, and they tell you the stuff they wish that someone had told them when they got started as writers.
You know, somebody can be a successful marketer and not necessarily provide a quality product.
I'm going to let Moses go because he's frothing at the mouth to talk about this one.
I like writing. I like reading. I like to immerse myself in books. So that seems like a pretty good career choice.
Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto.
Oh, you sound terrible. What happened? I'm just kidding.
Oh, man.
And now, podstructed on a zeppelin by an apprentice mage and delivered by rocket ship to a benevolent dragon, Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
Hello and welcome to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature. This is Sean Farrell.
This is Moses Sirigar.
And this is Sandra Wickham.
And this is Brent Bowen.
Okay, they're going to kill us for that. Yeah, just Moses and I tonight, and which is fine because tonight I really wanted to hear more about Moses's trip to Superstar Writing Seminar, and I'm really excited to hear about it. I've been waiting. Of course, I told Moses an email. I'm waiting to be made extremely jealous, do your worst, and I think he will. So we're going to have our interview with Brian Thomas Schmidt in a little bit, but for now we're going to turn this over to Moses, who has both some news to share and then his experience to share.
I didn't know we were going to have Brian on this episode. I'm stoked for that. That's cool.
I like to keep I like to keep some surprises for you, you know, make it fun.
That's awesome. Well, just a quick note we wanted to throw out there. Betsy Wolheim, you might know, is an editor at DAW, and this is her first time being on the ballot for the Hugo Award for the Best Editor Long Form. I think she's been at this 37 years, and it's her first time making it on the ballot.
Wow, even though 37, wow.
Yeah, even though she's edited people like Tad Williams, Mercedes Lackey, Patrick Rothfuss, Kristen Britton, recently Saladin Ahmed, and Laura Resnick, all kinds of great writers. She edited Who Fears Death, which won the World Fantasy Award, I think Best Novel last year. That's by, and I might get this wrong, it looks like Nnedi Okorafor. I've heard really great things about her from one of her writers, and she, as I've learned with the Hugo, I guess, if you're not out there doing like social media or, you know, promoting, you know, awareness of yourself a whole lot, she's not someone who really does a lot of that. She just, you know, focuses on her writers and does a good job, and you can see that in the quality of the books that she's putting out there. And so she's not someone who necessarily, you know, a lot of the voters might not know about her that much, and they might know about some people who are more well-known on the ballot. Now, I have to admit, sadly, Lou Anders is also on this ballot, and of course, Lou is a great friend of the podcast, and so, you know, we'd be happy, of course, to see either of them win. Lou won this one last year, right?
He did, yep. I have a picture of it on our Facebook page, me holding his Hugo when he's not paying attention, so I took it.
Oh, that's cool. But yeah, we just wanted to let the voters know you can vote up until July 31st. And Betsy Wolheim is on there. She's also a cool person to follow on Facebook if you're into like progressive politics, which I guess I am. So I have fun with the stuff that she posts on there.
I should note, too, that even though we didn't make the final ballot, I was told by several people who attended WorldCon last year that they voted for us to be on the ballot. So even though we didn't make it, I mean, I thought it was awesome that we got a couple nods to at least be looked at. So thanks.
Oh, totally. Thank you guys for doing that. And should we talk about Superstars Writing Seminars now?
Hit me. Do your worst.
All right. So I attended the third event this year. They've had three of these events. You guys have heard me talk about it before. And I have this neat perspective that I've actually been to all three of them so far. So I've gotten to see it, you know, each year. And quickly, it's put on by Kevin J. Anderson and his wife, Rebecca Mesta. And they always have three other people with them, David Farland, Brandon Sanderson, and Eric Flint. And each year they bring in other people. They really do a really good job. I'm really impressed with, you know, they bring in different people every year. Like in Salt Lake City last year, Tracy Hickman was there, Sherilyn Kenyon was there, all the Writing Excuses crew was there, so Dan and Howard and Mary, and of course Brandon. And so, you know, they do a neat job of mixing it up and giving you different inspiring authors. And it's basically a writing seminar where they, and this is funny, this is in our intro to the show where I said something like this once before, but they teach you about the business of writing and the things that they wish they knew if when they got started as writers a long time ago. So a few highlights from this year I wanted to throw out to you guys. One of the new people this year was James A. Owen. Are you familiar with him, Sean?
Only from your brief mention of him in the last episode.
Okay.
But not his work, no.
Okay. He was involved with comics at one point quite a bit, and he's moved more towards, I guess, writing YA fantasy, and now he does some like really kind of amazing inspirational talks, and he has a couple books now on that type of subject. And so let me go back to the one that they did in 2011 when Tracy Hickman was there. He gave the story that if you guys have listened to the podcast for a while, you might remember episode 108. We had Tracy Hickman on the show. Sean and I interviewed him, and he was reporting, you know, about his experience with having kind of done this interesting self-publishing experiment. Mm-hmm. And he told the story of the soldier. I guess it won't ruin the story. You can go back and listen to it, episode 108. But amazingly inspiring story about a soldier who was inspired by a character in Dragonlance, one of Tracy's books. And so that was like this sort of just incredible inspirational moment at the seminar in Salt Lake City where everyone was just silent and in awe of this incredible story that Tracy had. Well, this year, I think James Owen stepped into that role as the guy. This guy got the standing ovation this year from the crowd. Mm. And James was on a lot of the panels, so he was up there a lot. But he did one talk of his own, or at least one. And it was based on something he calls Drawing Out the Dragons. And you can actually get a book called Drawing Out the Dragons, which he has as a book. It's hardcover, softcover, ebook, and all that good stuff. He did a Kickstarter project for this thing. I looked it up. He raised over $11,000.
Wow.
on Kickstarter to create this book. And he had a goal of like 8,888, so he cleared it by quite a bit. So he's got quite a fan base because he's a really, really inspiring guy. And he's on Facebook and he's got a blog, and I guess he gets around and lectures a fair amount now too. What's cool about his lecture this year at Superstars is that you can hear it, or one that is almost identical to it. If you research James Owen, you can put James Owen and then LTUE, because he gave the keynote speech at LTUE this year, which is a seminar in Utah. You can find the audio of it online, and it's about 54 minutes long, the one that I found today. And it's almost verbatim the same exact thing. He's actually got it down to a pretty good science. You know, this lecture is pretty cool. You can't see some of the stuff he does because he actually does draw out a dragon. He'll put, you know, some paper on the wall, and he'll show people that it's not so hard to learn how to draw, you know, stuff. But it's not so much about that. It's more of a whole life story of his where he's overcome some pretty serious obstacles at times and shown a level of faith that a lot of people don't have in their creative, you know, work, and stuck through it and done some really inspiring things. So I think we can probably collect that. I'll collect that link for you guys and we'll put it in the show notes so you can hear his talk. You know, and that was one of the great moments at Superstars this year. And you can hear it for free online. Next time you have some time after you, you know, of course, after you listen to this episode.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. He was really cool. And actually, we may interview him for the podcast at some point too. I think I'm going to reach out to him and see if he wants to do that sometime.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And then, yeah, the book Drawing Out the Dragons, the book is basically the same as the lecture. I mean, it is a book, so it's a little bit more in depth. But you can kind of get it either way. You can listen to it, or, you know, or you can do both. I've read the book after hearing the lecture, and it kind of filled out a few interesting things, and I really liked that. So that was cool.
And let me jump in here, Moses. Speaking of Kickstarter books or books that were brought to life because of Kickstarter. At least Brent and I don't know if you jumped in on it too, Moses, we received our links just the other day for Tobias Bukel's The Apocalypse Ocean. The book is done, and I started reading it last night. So the hardcover isn't available yet, but there's something that we talked about last year and now has been completed, and we should maybe get Toby back on to see how that whole process worked for him from beginning to end. So I'm excited.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That felt good to do that. And yeah, I've considered doing a Kickstarter to try to raise some funds for some of my projects too, but it's so hard to do that. You know, it's so hard to, you got to organize it, and then you got to go, wait, who's going to give me any money for anything that I'm doing? And you don't know if they will or not, right?
But you'd be surprised.
Apparently, you know, because a lot of these Kickstarters do really well, you know, deserving people. But yeah, it's a neat thing that's taken off. So who else was new? This year they had Dean Wesley Smith. So I got to meet Dean Wesley Smith in person. And I'd hung out on his blog before and had conversations with him there. So it was really neat to meet him in person. And he of course, brought really interesting perspectives to everything. He did an amazing talk on copyright. And I've seen him on his blog talk about this too, where, you know, he seemed to really know what he's talking about. And then I heard him talk about it, and he really knows what he's talking about. Mm. And they do sell the recordings of this event as well. So if you ever want to go back and listen to previous years, or, you know, you can do that. And so you can get, you know, Dean's thing on copyright. And it may have been more than copyright. I'm trying to remember the actual name of the talk, but it was legal stuff that I don't understand very well. I can tell you that much. And I need to go back and listen to that one again. But that was really good material. And Eric Flint always puts out really good material too about how the publishing business works and how the finances break down, the percentages that go to all these different things and stuff in contracts, the things you want to be careful with in contracts and stuff like that. He's done that one pretty much every time they've done one, and that's a really good one too. Okay, so this year, I thought David Farland did a really great presentation this year too. The best one I think I've seen him do at Superstars, where he was just kicking out some serious writing advice. Mm. And speaking of kicking, his Daily Kick, of course, is a free thing you can subscribe to online, probably at davidfarland.net or .com. And he's been doing a good job keeping up with those recently. He you know, had slowed down for a while, but he's been putting them out like almost every day recently. So check him out. I think he just took over as the head judge for Writers of the Future too. So,
oh, he used to do that.
Yeah, I think there was another lady in there for a while, and then he came back in there. So congrats to him for being back on that.
Well, now it's Katie Wentworth who passed away. So,
oh, was it? I'm sorry.
Yeah, so maybe. Yeah, I guess they felt because he'd done it before that he'd be a good choice for it. Obviously, he is a great choice for it. But I'm sure the circumstances were not what he wanted to get back in that position, you know.
And you guys probably know he does workshops too. I've been to one of his independent workshops, one or two. I think it's one. And really, they are really great. If you want to, you know, go study with someone who really understands writing and what, how it works, how fiction works, and what makes readers want to read a certain book, and understanding the markets and so on. That's something you should feel jealous about if you've never done one of those, Sean. Like going to a David Farland workshop is definitely something to feel jealous about. I have been to one of those, and you haven't.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I hate you. who let you on this show? Yeah, go ahead.
Of course, Brandon Sanderson was there again. He moderates a lot of the panels. If you've ever heard Writing Excuses, you know how that goes. You know, he kind of goes in there. Usually he takes control and makes sure that all the people on the panel are giving useful information. He always does a great job with that. And, you know, it was really cool to hang out with him again this year. And that kind of leads me into one of the interesting things I've observed at Superstars is, okay, these events have been in the early part of the year, 2010, 2011, 2012. So I've been to three of them now. And of course, you know, the way publishing has changed is really drastic in that time. But for me, like, maybe nowhere has that been more evident than by attending these three events to see how significantly, you know, their advice about publishing has changed every year. So, for example, the first year, early 2010, I think it could have been March. It was very early. They didn't even have a panel on ebooks. It was on self-publishing. You know, and it was basically, don't do it. Self-publishing is for losers, which at that point, you know, it used to be, right? Pretty much, unless you got, you know, rich parents or, you know, or something like that. But it was pretty much a self-publishing, don't do it, it's not a good idea, which is the conventional wisdom for a long, long time. And they talked about ebooks back then, and it was almost like they weren't even mentioned hardly, because they mentioned that on the royalty statements back then, you know, they'd get like double digit ebook sales. I mean, they're like really pathetic, low ebook sales. It's interesting because Chris Rush had written some controversial or at least interesting provocative stuff about, you know, were publishers always reporting those numbers correctly? And there were some authors who got together and said, that doesn't seem to be adding up. So I do have to wonder a little bit if publishers were reporting if all of them were reporting the ebook royalties correctly back then. But because at that time these authors were like, we hardly sell any ebooks. I mean, this was not that long ago. This was like 2.5 years ago, not even 2.5 years ago. So that was like, you know, that was 2 years ago. That was ancient history, another lifetime, you know, some previous eon, another ice age or something. I mean, it was like a long time ago. And then the second year, we had a panel on ebooks, and I was on that panel with Eric Flint and Rebecca Mesta, and Howard Taylor was up there too. And that was just after like Amanda Hocking had happened and John Locke had happened, and you were starting to get some interesting success stories. And this was kind of the year when, you know, okay, something's changing. It's obviously something's going on here, but this doesn't quite compute with the way things have been for a long time. So The mind has a hard time taking in this new information, you know,
yeah.
Which is totally understandable. I'm sure if I'd been in the business for decades, it would have been a very strange information for me to take in too. And so that year was kind of I want to say a little contentious, the panel that we had there, because I was sort of the guy who represented, well, you know, you can do indie publishing too. And I think I got maybe a little bit of the brunt of that sort of defensiveness perhaps, or, you know, just not quite understanding where everything was going. And I think I stayed, you know, pretty mellow about it all and just sort of, you know, made my points. And but it was, you know, clearly things were happening and this was becoming a new thing. But there's still a lot of questions about it. They're like, well, you know, we don't really know. Things are changing. And they all could admit at that point things are really changing. So it's hard to say. And Brandon, to get back to him, that was the year when he said, you know, if you had two books, he'd send one to a New York publisher and he'd self-publish the other one.
Interesting.
Which was like, wow, that was interesting to hear Brandon say that, right? Well, this year, it was similar. Brandon said something very similar, but this year he was like, well, you know, again, he still thinks sending it to a big publisher is the best first option. He said, you know, send your first book there. And if you have another trilogy, self-publish a trilogy. So it was like, send one to a publisher and then have like three shorter books that you can make into a trilogy and self-publish those and see how it goes. Still with the idea that who knows what's going on and things are changing and it's all chaotic and all that sort of stuff. But it's interesting that he's actually self-publishing some stuff this year. So, you know, he's, you know, joining the ranks of many other people who are self-publishing their own ebooks this year. But what was interesting about the panel this year was like the whole subject was it was just way more mellow. It was just, you know, I was on the panel again. I was on there with Kevin and Eric and Dave Farland. And you know, and I gave a little presentation. I showed sort of the history of my sales month by month and how much money I've made. And I gave some examples of some people I know who are doing well. And I showed their graphs of their sales and how much money they're making and showed why I think they're doing well. And it was just super mellow. It was kind of pretty different than the year before. I think one of the people, Eric, disagreed with me a little bit on one point, and then Kevin and Brandon basically agreed with me and said, no, Moses is right. And then that was it. That was like the only like bone of contention the whole time. So it was just, you know, we went from like ebooks are nothing 2 years ago to, yeah, this is something that's definitely going on. And this is something you have to consider. And it's something you might want to do, you know. And the very end of the event, when we had a final Q&A, I asked Kevin and Brandon in particular, I said, you know, where do you think you guys might be in 5 years, if you could try to guess what your career is going to look like in 5 years. And they were pretty much like, I don't know. And it was interesting because, you know, Kevin had said, if you'd asked me this even 2 years ago, or maybe he said 1 year, but let's say 2 years, he said, you know, I would have had an answer for you. I would have said, you know, it would have been this and this and this, and here are my goals. Here's what I'm going to do. And he was pretty much like, well, you know, now I really don't know. You know, he's obviously keeping busy. He's doing things. He's actually working with James Owen on a book they're doing together. I think James is doing some of the illustrations for, it may be a YA series. I think it is. And so Kevin is writing it with James Owen. And Brandon, too, was, you know, I mean, he said, you know, I'm trying to self-publish some stuff. I'm still, obviously, you know, writing what I'm writing with Tor. But that was also really revealing that these two giants, you know, were pretty much like, I have no idea.
Well, I think so, Brandon has maybe, he should maybe have more of a clear idea because he signed a 10-book deal, right? So if nothing else, he has 9 massive fantasy tomes coming out.
True. Yeah, that's definitely the plan for those. But you know, it's still interesting that he's still very much kind of playing around and yeah, seeing how things work. And he's been doing a great thing. If you haven't seen this, he's done a creative writing course at BYU where he teaches. I'm pretty sure it's BYU. Definitely in Utah. And you can find that at writeaboutdragons.com. Writeaboutdragons.com. Not to be used with Drawing Out the Dragons by James Owen. But he's been, you know, someone's been recording his classes, and you can get a full, great, big, long classes that Brandon has been teaching. It's all free. It's all right there.
Sweet.
Yeah, he did a thing on self-publishing recently, and he talked about it, and, you know, he's definitely talking about what, you know, where he thinks it's a viable route, and so I watched that one, and he mentioned his third law of magic in one of those too. He's got his Sanderson's first law, second law, third law, which are pretty cool, and he revealed the third one sort of in one of those classes and talked about that. So there's some fun stuff to check out from his classes, and it's like, I really need to sit down and just watch the whole class. It's like, I would attend it. I would sit there and attend the class. Why don't I just sit down and watch it? You know, it's right in front of me. It's free. It's
like, yeah. Make an appointment every Tuesday and Thursday at 10 a.m. Just like if you were in the course.
Yeah. And it would be massively inspiring, I'm sure, you know, and the ones I have seen have been really interesting. Super interesting. So yeah, this year we were in Las Vegas. There, the first year was Southern California, and they're doing another one. I'm pretty sure it's May of 2013 in Denver. So it is a bit of a pricey event, but you get to hang out with these guys for 3 days. You get to ask questions, soak up their, you know, their awesome writerness, authorness, and it really blew my mind, expanded my mind. I've been 3 times and it still blew my mind just to see like how these guys are thinking in terms of, you know, movie deals and all these other things that they're doing that are huge, that you just feel like such a small little fish in the pond when you hang around these guys and see how they approach the business. And it really inspires you to take things up a notch if you're into that sort of thing. So I hope to be there next time too. And maybe some other folks will be there too that haven't been there before. Maybe some people listen to the podcast. And
well, I hope to join you there as well. I've never been to Denver. Sounds like a good excuse to go. So thanks, man. That sounds, gosh, every time you come back and talk about this, I want to go buy the CDs or the DVDs, but they're a little above my price point still. So even though I know they're worth it because of the information you get, but as Moses said, it's a little pricey, but yeah, you get what you pay for, you know, seriously.
That's true.
So, folks, we love your feedback on this. Come to the website, leave your comments there. If you were there and you're listening to this, please come and tell us a little bit about your experience there. And I know we just had our interview with Eric Flint last episode, so come check that out, too, if you haven't heard that already. So, Moses, we're going to sign off. Is there anything else that we needed to mention?
I guess we're good for now.
All right, we'll be back soon, though. We're getting more into the groove again. Let's go ahead and get on with our interview with Brian. There'll be a little break in there in the middle of the interview, and we'll see all of you next time. So thanks for listening, and Moses, thank you for running with this one and filling us in on your great experience.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was really scary. More than a century ago, UEP Captain Julius Verndock helped end a galactic war with Majesty, the first truly living machine, thanks to man-made artificial intelligence. For decades, Majesty and humanity had lived together in harmony, with mankind reaping the benefit of a world free of disease, famine, and even aging. But when Majesty decided she wanted to birth her own AI offspring, a joint interplanetary military effort fought and finally defeated her, and then eradicated all existing artificial intelligence. Or so they thought. Inspired at an early age by the works of Jack Chalker and Timothy Zahn, author A.J. Vega gives us Majesty's Offspring, a new science fiction novel bursting with action and suspense on a truly galactic scale. To learn more, visit our website, adventuresinscifipublishing.com, and click on the image for Majesty's Offspring, or visit majestiesoffspring.com. And as of the time of this recording, Majesty's Offspring is free for both Kindle and Nook. That's right, free for a limited time. So what are you waiting for? Majesty's Offspring, new science fiction from A.J. Vega.
This is Brent Bowen at Conquest 43 in Kansas City. I'm pleased that we found time to put my next guest on the other side of the microphone this weekend. He's the author of the acclaimed debut science fiction novel, The Worker Prince, and the creator of the SFFWRTCHT, the Science Fiction Writer Chat.
Science Fiction and Fantasy.
Fantasy Writer Chat. Ooh, I shouldn't leave that fantasy out, should I?
No.
Twitter interview series. His second novel in the Davi Ree saga, The Returning, will launch summer 2012. Brian Thomas Schmidt, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back to the show.
That's right. In fact, 3 weeks till the novel launches, so pretty exciting time.
Now, The Worker Prince debuted last year, and The Returning is slated for the release in 3 weeks here. Tell our listeners who are unfamiliar with the Davi Ree saga a little bit about it, especially what we can expect for Davi in book two.
Well, you know, book one was really about the coming of age for Davi, but now he's come of age, and, you know, they've won one victory, and everybody's trying to settle in. The problem is there's still people who aren't happy with the outcome. So you've got a situation where there's some killers trying to kill off the opposite side, which are the former slaves, the workers. And Davi gets involved investigating and finds out there's people trying to kill him too. So he's been hunted down. So there's a lot of tension and a lot of that going on. And he and his friends, Yao and Farian, have to go out and do an investigation. In the meantime, he settled into a nice relationship with Taylor. They've been together for about a year. There's about, I don't remember, it's 9 months to a year gap in between the two novels. And he settled in with Taylor, who he fell in love with in the first book. And all of a sudden, they're having some relationship issues, you know, trying to settle in and figure out their future. You know, they're talking about getting married, but, you know, Taylor's got to grow him up a little bit first, or, you know, he's got to, you know. You know, it's nothing that none of us have ever dealt with. You never dealt with your wife, right, Brent? You never had that. No.
Maturity issues?
Yeah. or in some cases, he's a little overprotective, perhaps, you know, yeah. And things like that, you know. Those kind of issues, you know. And so there's some a little bit of tension going on there as well. But you also have a situation where his mother, Princess Miri, is no longer a princess. So she's got to settle into being a civilian. Got Aron, the leader of the workers, has become an official member of the council, so he's the first representative of his people on the council. And there's some other issues going on, and plus Salivar's kind of mad at some things that happened, and he's coming back trying to bring some things. So it's a pretty complicated plot, as it sounds like. I got a lot of things going on, like the first book did.
Sure.
But I really wrote, it's really more of a thriller. Everybody kind of compares it to like the Ludlum's Born books and things like that. They said every time you feel like you can relax, something big happens, and you're like, oh my God, what was that? You
know? Which is interesting, you know, because we were talking about that, you having the thriller elements in this book, but then it's also, I'm really fascinated to see how you structured that with the notion of, we've won the rebellion, you know, we've succeeded in the rebellion, now we're picking up the pieces and trying to construct, reorder society as well. So how did you make that interplay work?
I'm trying to figure out how to do this without spoiling book one, but since you already did that. Oops! No. Well, I mean, look, in book two, you know, they won the first round, convincing them that maybe they deserve to have a shot at citizenship. So they've got citizenship, they've had it for about a year. But there are people on the Boralian side who still resent that, not just Zalivar, but other people. And, of course, as you integrate new people with new rights into society, you find out that all of a sudden, the people who used to be able to force to do jobs have the skills to advance themselves and get themselves to a new economic position. Well, that starts hurting the Boralians who used to have those jobs, because the workers don't want to work for them anymore. Mm-hmm. They want the Vertilians, the workers, want to be their own people. Well, so now there's an economic crisis because the people need jobs, and they're like, oh, they're taking our jobs. Yes. You know, so it's a little bit like the immigration crisis we have in the U.S. And so there's some of those issues going on. And then there's also the situation of people who still don't believe that they're fully human and that they deserve the full citizenship. So all of those kind of interplays going on. Plus, they're trying to be the Vertolians are trying to be good citizens and try to adjust. And one of the issues that comes up is the returning is a happens to be a religious holiday that they have when they believe that, you know, kind of their God returned to be with his people. And the idea, Tarkanius, who's now the leader, taken over after Zalivar, has decided that, you know, they can make it a holiday for the whole system without making it religious. Just, it'll be a day off for everybody. If the Vertolians want to celebrate it religiously, that's great. Nobody else has to.
Okay. Okay.
But then there's some rub about that, because they're like, well, why are we nationalizing, or I don't know how to describe what the word for the whole system, but, you know, why are we making it official a religious holiday for somebody? We don't do it for any other group, you know? So there's some of that rub going on. Mm-hmm. And some of that, so there's the typical scheming that goes on in Congress, in the Council.
Behind the scenes, that's where some
in
of the
Council
of
Lords, which there's a lot of that going on in Book One. And you'll find that there's a lot of people manipulating people and doing stuff as it goes on. It gets more complicated. You're like, oh my God, you know. That's the kind of thing I had, and I just had to up the stakes. Because one of the things you run into, and I know you wanted to ask me about this, so I'll go ahead and get to it, is the whole Book Two syndrome thing. Because one of the things you run into is you're like, okay, with Book One, you can kind of give it an ending where if they don't like it and they don't ask me to write another book, it kind of feels done. There's characters survive that maybe you want to see them get their comeuppance, or you want to see what happens, but the reality is it still feels like a closure. But with Book Two, you know you're just leading into a Book Three, because mm-hmm. it's a trilogy. So the hardest part of writing it was trying to find an ending. So what I realized is that one of the reasons I went with the thriller aspect is I said, I have got to make it tense to a point where I can make a chapter ending that isn't going to be as complete as the first book's ending or as the third book's ending, so it feels like a complete thing. And the only way I knew how to do that was to write a surprise story. Now, there's two different kinds of suspense stories. There's a suspense story and a surprise story. A suspense story is a guy's walking down the street. Camera cuts to a banana peel on the sidewalk. The suspense is he going to slip on the banana peel, or is he going to avoid it? The surprise story is a guy's walking down the street, bam, slips, falls on his butt, cut to the banana peel. So the approach that I was taking, that's something I learned in film school, by the way, as far as techniques. And so what I was taking was just when you think you know what's going on, everything goes in a totally different direction. You're like, holy crap. So, you know, there's some people we like are going to die. Some people we don't like are going to die. Some things are going to happen in Book Two. It gets real more intense, and things are not going to feel as wrapped up as they did at the end of Book One, because it really needs to continue. So it really ends on a big cliffhanger. So... And the other thing is, if you look at the, you know, yes, it's been admitted already that I'm in some ways trying to capture the feel of Star Wars. When you look at the Star Wars saga, Star Wars: A New Hope was Luke Skywalker's coming of age story. Ultimately, that was the bulk of the story, and he was the hero. But Book Two, Han Solo actually had more lines, and it kind of took over in the Han and Leia, and it was a chase movie where pretty much everybody was being chased. Chasing each other, and that was a different kind of movie than the first movie, but they still captured the feel of the characters and stuff, but they took it to a different place. And then the third movie was a different kind of movie altogether. So I'm going to be doing much of the same thing here. The third book for me is called The Exodus, and I think you can figure out, since it's the Moses story, what's happening there, you know? It's not going to end the way you think it'll end, but still, it's, you know, there's going to be a almost like a Battlestar Galactica fleet of people trying to leave, you know, kind of thing. So anyway, you know, a ragtag fugitive fleet.
Fleet and
lonely quest.
And the plan, and that's a question I was going to ask you, because I mean, framing it, like as you mentioned, around the Star Wars, since you mentioned the Star Wars universe, is the notion of you're planning on committing trilogy, right?
It's definitely a trilogy. There was a while where I was debating whether it was going to be a trilogy or there would be a fourth book, and I still, until I ultimately write it, I don't really know, but I think I can do it in one book. I actually want to go back eventually and write a prequel trilogy, and I'm actually working on a children's book about when Davi, Yao, and Ferry and her little kids, and how they met. It's going to be a book about friendship.
Kids.
Yeah. I have an artist named Sherry Dean that I'm going to try to work with on that, but I'd like to do a YA trilogy at some point. But, you know, and you say frame Star Wars. Well, no, I'm not really framing it. I'm really trying. I do borrow pop culture elements from a lot of different things. Book One, I borrowed from Superman and a lot of different things. In Book Two, it's more of like, for example, I get to pick some of my favorite lines from movies and have my character say it and actually make it work. You know, there's some little, you can look for those kind of references. It's kind of fun if you know it. I make it work so it's not like ridiculously out of place funny in the context, but it's an inside joke.
If you're in the community or you understand that pop culture reference, it'll strike home for you.
But I'm definitely writing a Star Wars type of story, and I want to capture that kind of feel. The kind of fun that people had. And so that's more than a framework. That's really where I'm going.
It's threading the feel more so than a framework.
Right.
You mentioned the book two syndrome. So we'll talk about that, and so I can give context to that, because what you mentioned was part of it as well. So when I interviewed Blake Charlton a year and a half or so ago, and he talked about this idea of book two syndrome, which part of it is because you've been working on this book, at least in your head, for how long? The worker prints, for how long?
Well, I had the idea when I was like 15, so it was really 27 years after the fact, you know.
Okay, so you start...
But I didn't write it for 27 years. I sat down in 2009 and started to actually finally write it. But the idea had been gestating for all those years, and I've been thinking about it and coming up with ideas and saying, someday I'm going to write this novel. So,
but it was there in the head. And so the idea of the book two syndrome, when I talked to Blake, was, you know, even in concept, you've been working on the book 10 plus years. I mean, and then you see it delivered, you see success, and then now you have less than a year to complete book two. And with the same quality, mind you, the expectation is the same quality. So how did you make that work?
Well, what's kind of interesting is, like, typical book contracts with like a trade house out of New York is going to be, if they'll buy a trilogy, and you're going to have a deadline a year apart for each book. So the first book, you've had all this time to prepare and get it in shape before you turn it in, which is what you're talking about.
Yeah.
But then you only have a year for this one. Now, in my case, they buy them a book at a time. I don't have a contract at book three, so I don't have to go with the same publisher. I probably will. It's really good for the series. But the point is, I'm not saying I'm not going to. I'm just saying that I'm not obligated by contract. Okay. Yeah. The reality of it is that I could have had longer time. The hard part about writing it for me actually was... And I've been pretty public about this, so I'll say it here. My whole life fell apart. Between the fact that I've been unemployed 24 months, on top of that, my wife got severe mental illness, and our marriage fell apart, and she was put in and out of the hospital. Spent 6 months of last year in mental hospitals in various places, and had to be put there against her will, so there was a lot of drama. And so I'm trying to write in the middle of that. So the hard part of this was, I had recruited beta readers, and they were going to read a chapter at a time, but literally it would be like a whole month where I didn't touch it, and they're like, where's the next chapter? Where's the next chapter? And so they were like, I can't remember what happened. You know, it was very hard for them, but it was really hard for me to know if I, you know, like there was one, I actually repeated a whole section, two scenes of the same thing written totally differently. I put it in there like a scene apart. Go back, wait a minute, what is this? You know, didn't even realize it, stuff like that. But, you know, the funny part was that surprised me. Because when I wrote book one, there was some drama going on, too, and different things, because we moved across country and my wife didn't start to have her health issues. But I wrote every day, and it was a different kind of thing on the first book. But for some reason, the good part about all this drama that was going on is it was really easy to just put the thing aside and say, I'm not going to touch it for a while, after I got it done, and come back. And when I did come back, you know, I had another beta reader go through the final version after I incorporated the notes from my beta readers, because my process is, I'll get, you know, fellow writers or friends like Brent or somebody to read it, and I say, that's fine, I'm going to look at the first chapter's notes just to make sure you're giving me the kind of thing I need, and I give them a system. You know, A is a, you know, they really like it. B is boring. C is confusing. And D is for some other note they want to put on there, and they can put notes. The idea is to make it really easy for them. All they have to do is A, B, C, D. And then if they want to give me more notes, they can. But at least I get something that gives me an idea of what I need. That's my system. It's actually on one of my blog posts. And the other thing I did was I did not allow my beta readers to read book one until they had read book two, because I wanted to make sure that I got the story imparted well enough for a new reader who would come in. So I deliberately, you know, I as a gift for doing the beta reading, I gave them all copy book one, but I said, I'm not giving it to you until I'm done. And actually, I didn't give them the ending, because the ending was one of those who shot JR things, and I didn't want it out there. So they basically read through chapter 12. Well, we don't get to know what happens. I'm like, that's fine, but I just mailed you a copy of the first book. And they read it, and they universally said, it's a better book. So when I went back through with the other beta readers' notes and finally started looking at it myself, you know, it was fun for me, because I was like, oh, wow, I did that. That's totally cool. I forgot I did that. You know, the twists and turns surprised me. And I was like thinking it would be a bunch of crap, because I'd written in such chaos And it was a lot better than I thought. I mean, you know, we all have our weaknesses. I'm sure people will find plenty to criticize. But the reality is, it was a better book as far as I was concerned. I learned a lot. And then you incorporate stuff in your process that, like, there were like probably ultimately 19 drafts of Worker Prince, not complete drafts. There would be a draft where I learned, oh, there's this thing I got to do with point of view. Okay, I'm just going to do a draft where I'm going to deal with that. Or I just learned about the 10% solution. I'm going to go cut 10% of the excess words, do a pass just for that. Whereas this time when I'm writing, all that stuff was part of my initial process. As I go, yeah. And then as I rewrite, you know.
It wasn't some after filter, after effect you tried to apply. Yeah,
yeah. The after filter, what it tends to be is, I do my initial draft. I'm trying to get the plot and the characters down and get a basic idea of that because I'm a pantser typically. But the second draft is always longer. Resnick always tells me his is longer too. Most writers say their second draft is shorter because they cut a bunch of stuff. Well, all the descriptive detail and the emotional detail goes into the second draft for me. Not all of it, but the bulk of it. I really go back and look for where those opportunities are and put them in because I can't multitask well enough to do all that yet. So I focus on the plot and characters. Now, when I'm doing sequels, I found that I outline more than normal because I have to, because there's so many things I'm juggling. The themes and the different things that happen to people, and you have to get it in there and you have to figure out and how to use characters. And the other thing that I did, the other thing that's challenging is I use more point of views in book two because, of course, I had characters I'd introduced. But you also have to be careful about that, and you have to be careful. I also tried really hard not to introduce too many new characters because I tried to find ways to use characters I already had and bring them back into the story. Sure. So there are a couple stories, a couple characters who go through some events you'll be kind of surprised, but because of the trauma that's going on, it makes sense. And so, but that was my way of using other characters well rather than kind of introducing a bunch of new characters. And there are some new characters, and some of those are the alien leaders of the various planets in the system, the 13 planets in the system, because all of a sudden the aliens want citizenship too. So there's some issues going on
there. Okay.
So that's good, and that's going to be a big part of the third book.
Okay. Is the aliens demands of citizenship?
Right. That whole issue.
That whole angle. Well, it sounds like on book two, with everything you've had going on, that's really helpful is that emotional. Okay, it sounds like you made an emotional commitment to that second book where you may have not been contractually obligated. So,
well, you know, the funny thing about emotions too is because of all the extremely painful and difficult emotions I was going through in my life, there's a lot of emotion in the scenes. So you read it and it's all the more intense and powerful because I was like exercising my demons through my characters, you know?
It's so cathartic.
Oh my God, they're so mad. How did you write them so they're so mad? It's so believable, you know? And then there's these little scenes with Taylor and her father that are very emotional. And people were like, how'd you get? Well, it's like, because I can totally feel that, you know? And when I read it again, I feel it. I mean, I feel the thing. I flash back to whatever event, you know, I was going through at the time. But it makes it a better book. And that's how you as a writer can use what's going on, despite how painful and negative it may be in some level, to make your book better and make it more real.
Well, here's to hoping 2012 is a much better year on a personal level, okay? Yeah,
well, it already has been. You know.
Good, good.
Anytime you get to hang out with Brent Bowen, it's a better year, I'm telling you.
Well, speaking of, you ended 2011 on a high note. From a book standpoint. So one of the things we haven't talked about was the Worker Prince. Even though you were mashing over those after filters and after effects of the 10% and working through some of the other things of applying more detail or point of view, the Worker Prince still managed to be named a Barnes & Noble Best Sci-Fi Book of 2011 Honorable Mention. Yep. What did that acknowledgement mean to you personally?
Well, you know, it made me feel like, okay, I really have a right to hold my head up when I talk to people like Mike Resnick. You know, Mike's become a friend of mine, but when you're talking to somebody who's like, as far as I'm concerned, Mike's a legend. I mean, he's humble enough not to call himself that yet, but he's certainly a very award-winning guy, and he's going to be one of the, I'm sure, a grandmaster or somebody someday. He's one of those guys. So when you're, and I'm, because of Science Fiction Fantasy Writers Chat, I'm very fortunate to get to talk to a lot of people like that, and I have built relationships with them, and many of them encouraged. In fact, Mike was kind enough to blurb book two, so he's on the front cover, his recommendation of the book, and he enjoyed it. And, you know, the thing about it was that now when I talk to those people, I don't feel like I'm a hack anymore. You know, it's like I pretend to be a writer, but you guys are real writers, you know?
Writers, yeah.
I mean, I've got a long way to go. There's a lot of legitimate criticism was made. I had some point of view jumping in book one that I didn't catch, and some things that I needed to work on, and some of my it was a too much tell and not enough show in some cases, and there's some things that I got to work, and I can admit that. I mean, we're all growing. It's the first novel, and everybody, I mean, the writer's life is a journey, called a journey for a reason. I mean, if you ever stop learning, if you ever think you learned everything, you're probably going to start writing really bad because, you know, you've forgotten that there's so much more to learn. But anyway, the point is, to answer the question, I know it's a roundabout way, was, you know, I had sent this to Paul Goat Allen, and Paul Goat Allen was somebody who I had been involved in the forums of the Barnes & Noble Book Club, and they do a lot of book discussions, and he's the science fiction fantasy guy. And Paul Goat Allen's the guy who's written reviews for Publishers Weekly and New York Times for book review. And I mean, he's
widely acclaimed.
He's read like 6,000 books. I sent him my book because he asked me to, because he knew I had a book coming out. And I never heard anything. He never did a review or anything. And then all of a sudden, it popped up on the list, and I literally... I'm calling my friend. I'm like,
jumped out of your skin.
No, I'm like, I just sent you a link. I need you to read it and be sure to read the bottom part and tell me that I'm not seeing things because I think something happened. I might need to go to the doctor. No, because I couldn't believe it because it was one of the very few really micro press books that was listed, and I just couldn't believe my name. I'm right there next to John Wright and John Scalzi and Ben Bova. I mean, they're right there on the list. And it was like, oh my God, how did this happen? It was hugely humbling. It was hugely, of course, yeah, I felt great about it. But at the same time, you know, the best part about it was feeling like, okay, despite the flaws that existed, it's not total crap. Because if a guy who reads 6,000 books could like it. And later, you know, Paul was kind enough. I said, you know, I thanked him so much for it. And I said, you know, I was very humbled by that. And because you didn't give it a review, so I assumed you probably didn't like it. And that's cool. He said, no, you know, and he gave me his feedback, you know. And he's got book two and recently said, you know, asked me, he said, it's really important. I need to know what the release date is. He may be doing a review of that. I don't know. But you know.
Did he share both sides of the coin? He gave you feedback,
oh,
both
yeah,
positive and both positive.
I'll tell you exactly what he said. He said, I thought it was very well written. He said, oh, there's a few things here and there, but I thought it was very well written. But I think there's some places where the things you did probably were a little bit too predictable. You could have done a few things that were a little more surprising. So when I sent him book two, I said, I took that in mind when I wrote this book, so just keep that in mind. Because book two really is unpredictable in a lot of ways. You know, I learned, when you get feedback, the best thing to do is learn from it, if there's something you can learn. And I did that with several people. I had a person who criticized the fact that I used real religion in the book and thought that I didn't preach, but I put too much of it in there. So I've kind of downplayed that in book two because I'm not really trying to teach anybody religion and preach it. It's just, it's about an ideological warfare, an ideological bigotry. And I don't know how to tell that story without telling you what the ideology is so you know where the conflicts come from.
Politics, religion, and economics.
Yeah, I mean, right. And so you're going to offend somebody, but that reviewer said, I couldn't finish the book, and I had problems with it. And it's actually Bookworm Blues. It's Sarah Chorn. She's a good friend of mine, and so I know she won't mind me telling you this. And she was so worried to tell me because she thought that I was going to hate her. And she'd been attacked by people for reviewing her book. And I said, no, let's unpack it. Because she actually, when you read the Not review, she said, it's a really great debut. I'd be very proud. And she had so many complimentary things. It was just the religion that bothered her. So it actually wasn't a negative review, but it came off because of the tone.
Yeah.
And so she actually, here's to her credit, later on, she actually came back and took it down. And she said, I'm rereading this book because I figured out that my bad experience with religion in the past totally made me biased about that book. And she said, you deserve a better shot. And she's rereading it right now, and she's reading book two. So that was really meaningful to me, too, because there's some integrity there. I mean, if she still doesn't like the book, it's fine. But it was pretty obvious to everybody who read her review that there was a bias going on there towards any real religion. She's like, you know, if you called it something else, it wouldn't have bothered me. But because you called it Christianity, it bothered me. And I was like, see, to me, that's silly. A lot of people do that. But if you're going to write Islam and Christianity and basically just call them by a different name, why bother? Everybody's going to figure out what it is.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
You know? And I also needed something to anchor it with the modern world. And there's an ideological battle going on in our culture. And so I wanted to, you know, how might that play out in the future? How might it affect relationships? And that's what I wanted to look at. Not to be preachy, but because it's a good connector when you're writing something so far in the future. And the fact that they were from Earth and that some of them had a Christian heritage, so the original Moses story was part of their heritage, was interesting. But it also allowed me to depart from the Moses story because, how likely is it that they're going to relive the exact same history they had? So there are parallels, but then I could just say, oh, no, but it didn't happen the exact same way, and I go off on my different thing, and it made, you know, a lot more sense, and I avoid offending people who are like, why are you changing the Moses story at the same time, you know? Because, I mean, I found a lot of people, even non-Christians, who enjoy those stories because there's some great storytelling. So, you know, it just gave me a lot more options, so it was interesting. The fact is, reviews They're hard because it's a piece of your heart you're putting out there. It's always hard when somebody doesn't like it. But for me, I always say, like, I saw somebody the other day that reviewed my friend's book, and they're like, I didn't like it. Here's a link to Kirkus. This review pretty much sums up what I thought. And I said, you know, that's cheating. Tell me why you didn't like it, so I know that you at least engaged with it enough to get my book, and then I can get something out of it that will help me as improve as a writer. If you can't articulate it and you have to use somebody else's review, I'm not even sure if you really read it or got it, you know? And that doesn't help me, because actually, I'm looking at you as an opportunity to teach me how to be a better writer.
Sure.
This episode is brought to you by the new science fiction novel Wolf Dawn by Susan Cartwright. Ashton Chayton was born with a powerful gift, a unique inhuman ability. Orphaned, raised by the Red Wolves of Open, captured and enslaved, he is now free and on the run. Unfortunately, everybody wants Ashton. Admiral Jones will torture him to get the secret of his power. Lady Linda feels he is the one, as named in Temple Prophecy. The influential Lord Andros just wants him dead. Ashton only wants two things, revenge and the Lady Linda. If you had unique powers, wouldn't you use them to get what you want? Wolf Dawn is one of the first titles from Hotspur Publishing, and it is a title not afraid to explore material some would call controversial. That said, this is a fast-paced adventure novel that will keep you turning pages, and publisher David Bischoff says it is written in the vein of Dune and Ender's Game. Come to our website and click on the image for Wolf Dawn to learn more, or go to SusanCartwright.com to learn more about the author and the novel. Wolf Dawn, new science fiction by Susan Cartwright.
Well, it's good. It's interesting you talk about both sides of that, both the acknowledgments and some of the critical feedback and helping you as a writer. And again, congratulations on the recognition.
Thank you.
For the first book, because that when I saw that and I saw the recognition, I was like, Brian had to have been at least so pleased and rewarded on the effort, because I know the type of effort you put into the Worker Prints.
It does feel like you won an award. It really does. But at the same time, it's kind of like when we talked to the interview you guys will probably hear that we did with Gardner and Rich, and we asked him, what does it really mean to have your story in the Year's Best? And, you know, he said most of that stuff, it doesn't, you know, it gives you a little prestige. It makes you feel good about yourself. It's an ego boost. But in the long run, it doesn't mean there's not a lot of other really great stories and things out there. But it is nice to feel like, I mean, one thing that it did that really helped me on a personal level, though, was that it had more impact on my parents than it did me, because all of a sudden, all my life, my dad's a doctor, my mom's a nurse, there's been this pull between the artistic son and the parents who want me to have a practical, real career goal. All of a sudden, they backed off because they're like, well, you know what? Maybe he could really make a career of this because he's getting this kind of acclaim.
A little
and
validation.
Of course, they were pretty proud of it, but at the same time, you know, it gave it a legitimacy in their eyes that really kind of changed things. So that was actually probably the best reward of the whole thing.
Well, speaking of rewards, and this may be even more rewarding, so the validation's nice, certainly from that relationship standpoint. But let's talk about relationships a little bit in the field. And your acknowledgments page for the returning really spoke to me about how active you've been in the community, and not just with the Twitter chat. I mean, you and I have been all over the place on this con this weekend, and you amaze me from the standpoint of, you see a byline from you just about anywhere. It's, you know, it's on SF Signal, which is a Hugo nominee, so congratulations, because I view you very much as part of the team there, because you're contributing.
I'm once a month contributor, and every once in a while guest post. But yeah, they're great people to work with.
It's a team app, but that's a team app.
It is a team app, very much. And John DiNardo is very gracious about acknowledging that, and I have to say, he's a great guy. There are people that are definitely more actively contributing, so, you know, but thank you, nonetheless.
Yes. Well, you're contributing.
I definitely want them to win the Hugo, though. I'm rooting for them.
And I will be as well, because I've been lobbying for them for years and told John
they
that
really
to
do
his
great
face
work.
That,
yeah.
Yeah, they do great work. Now, you've been contributing to our podcast and a number of other venues, including the convention. You've been active in the convention here. How do you make time for it all?
Well, when you're 24 months unemployed from a full-time job, you suddenly actually find you have more time. Unlike Glenn Cook, who found that he spent his time watching anime when he was in retirement, I have not allowed myself to get addicted to that form of crack. I have avoided others. You know, I go for more of the plumber pants crack. No, I'm kidding. It's discipline. First of all, my dad's a workaholic. I swore I wouldn't be, but I obviously am, because I'm always doing something. But first of all, I really enjoy it. The reason I started doing Science Fiction Fantasy Writer Chat is because when I went to my second con was World Fantasy in Columbus, and Brent was there, and several other people were there, and the thing about it is that, which ironically, Brett is one of the first people I met in science fiction because we met at Conquest, my first con ever, 2 years ago. Yeah. And here we are again. But the funny thing is that I said, you know, it is so awesome to have this kind of access to these authors. I didn't know it existed. I'd never had it before. And to learn from them and what they're saying on these panels, I'm like, how can I leverage technology and my knowledge from years of film school and working in Hollywood and film? I worked for A&E's Biography, and I worked for the History Channel for a long time, okay, doing interviews, doing all that stuff. So how can I leverage that in a way that I can bring the con into people's homes and help my fellow writers and myself? I'm basically taking it's. People ask, like, thank you for doing it. Thank me. You're giving me a free master's class every week.
Yeah,
know?
No doubt.
It's awesome. So, and I've been able to build relationships. And I mean, and I'm at the point now where people respect it that I interviewed Robert Silverberg. I'm going to be interviewing Ginger Buchanan coming up. Ginger Buchanan is a very well-known senior editor at Ace Rock. So the Penguin Group, you know, New American Library. So Robert Sawyer actually came on and chatted live with us. You know, the names get bigger and bigger, which is very humbling for me because, I mean, these people are, you know, people that I admire just as much as anybody else, you know. But I said, well, you know, if I'm going to be an author, I'm going to have to get my name out there. And the way that I learned, because I'm not, I mean, we all have egos, but I really am not one of those people that's like a Mr. Braggart. I don't like to talk about myself that much. I love to talk about my work and those aspects, but talking about me is humbling. I've kind of learned to do it, but the reality of it is, my family, my dad's a doctor, my mom's a nurse. They were very involved with church and very involved with community organizations, gave a lot of money to charity and did a lot to help people. And my grandmother was that way. So our whole family really believes in service. So my thought was the best way I can get my name out there is to find a way to serve. So I created Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers Chat. And I started with the people I knew from World Fantasy, Blake Charlton. Sam Sykes was my first guest. He's coming on a little over a week away and going to finally be the second return, guest. You know, I started with people like Mike Resnick, who didn't even really have Twitter but got on Twitter to do it. You know, I had to teach him how to do it, which was fine because Mike's admittedly part of a generation that he gets a little bit technically challenged, and we did a practice run. But, you know, I started out with people I knew, and then it got so successful that Pyre and some publicists started offering me books and contacting me. And now I pretty much work with every major publisher and can request books when I want. And I try to buy some, too, because I don't like to... I mean, authors need to earn a living, and so do publishers. So I try not to take unfair advantage of it. And, you know, sometimes... But a lot of times they send me books that I can't use because I only have 52 weeks a year. But so if I have a book that I can't use, not because I don't want to, but simply because I don't have enough time in the day to read all these books, if I will literally find somebody... That's why I started bringing reviewers onto Science Fiction Fantasy Writers Chat. We have Michelle Restuccia, who does a really great job with the YA interviews and has done a lot. And her column YA Report is one of the most popular things on that site. We get unbelievable amount of attention from it. So anyway, the point is, I find somebody who will do a review of it and use it so that they get their value out of it. Or I use it as a giveaway or something so that they get some publicity out of it. Because if they're kind enough to give me a free book, I want them to get something for that. I know a lot of people don't do that. That's just kind of personal. I just feel like that's my... it's the same way I feel about trying to read the books before I interview people. I feel like if I'm going to talk about craft with you, I need to at least be familiar with your craft. You know, so I started getting enough excess interviews and also enough big name people who don't, like Charlene Harris, who were like, you know, their publicist was like, would you like to interview them? I said, yeah. She said, but they don't do Twitter. And I said, oh. So I went to John DiNardo and I said, hey, John, you know, I'm doing all my Twitter interviews and turn them into transcripts and put them on Grasping for the Wind. And occasionally I do special ones for him, but I'm getting invites for all these other ones. And John's like, are you giving me your throwaways? Because I don't want your junk pile. And I'm like, no, I'm not giving you my junk pile. I said, I'm going to set up a special set of interviews just for SF Signal with some big names. And I had Jack McDevitt, and I got, or I don't know, is it Devitt or McDevitt? I don't know how to pronounce it. I'll have to ask him. And then I had Joe Haldeman and Robert Silverberg, and now Charlene, and I've got the first time ever all the year's best editors are getting together and doing a joint interview with me, and that's in the works coming up. And so it's been really great. And so I end up having to read 6 books a month instead of 4 that I have to read, so it takes out my time. But really the truth is, you just have to do what I did in college, working full-time and going to school full-time, is budget your time.
Well, and you do more than that. We talked about that, and I want to touch on the discipline thing. So from a tip standpoint, you know, there's all this social media out here, and I think this is where you could probably teach a lot of folks a master class on managing managing social media, and before we turned on the microphone, we had this conversation about contributing to a blog and what your even your own personal blog schedule looks like and how you manage that. What are some of the tips? I mean, on structuring and managing that content. It's like, so people know before they get into it, it's not, you know, some people can do it on a daily basis,
right?
But you know, with all the contributions that you make, you obviously it's a discipline. But take us back behind the curtain just a little bit.
Well, okay, look, here's the way I approach it. I'm trying to write a certain serious level of content. It's not that I don't have a sense of humor, and it's not that I can't be funny, but I'm trying to write it at a certain level. I'm not just going to write about, oh, I had eggs for breakfast for the fifth time in a row.
Yeah,
it's just set time for me to switch it to a different brand of eggs. Oh, these Kleenex totally infected my nose. It's time for me to switch brands. Puffs, you're no good. You know, there are people who do that, and there are people who like to follow them because they're funny when they do it, and that's great, but it's not my thing. And I know a guy who has a blog, and he won't let anybody post more than 400, and I tried to write a post for him, and I couldn't do it because I couldn't do 400 words. I'm like, I can write you a guideline, but I can't do the kind of post I'm used to doing with the points and the kind of quality that I feel obligated to do in that setting. There's nothing wrong with it. He's got a very popular blog. People like it. He has great relationships. It's just I couldn't do it. And so what I've learned to do is, first of all, because I do write tips every Monday, and then Thursday might be another write tip or various other kinds of posts, and then other days in between I have guest posts from other people, or sometimes I don't post that day, but it's for extra things, or my conquest schedule or whatever. Once a month at the end of the month, I've got the Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. I missed 1 month, but I do an essay for them. There's a new one up that just came up this month. It'll be for May and June. And I also do once a month an interview for SF Signal and an interview for Raygun Revival. I'm doing a space opera series for them. So all of those are pretty locked in as to there's a time frame. You start them at the beginning of the month. Give the people 3 weeks to get back to you. It takes about an hour to format it when you get it back. If you send it to them, just write in an email, mm-hmm. and you're done, okay? And I can do it all in my WordPress, put it in HTML and put it in an email. They paste it, and it's done for them. I can paste it myself. But it's a beautiful – I all the time will open a new post in WordPress and write it so the HTML is all there, and then cut and paste the HTML into the other WordPress blog because it's done. Because I can save it on my blog without, you know, confusing John and having it posted early on something all that, and get it the way I want it. And actually, I can also embed pictures. I don't have embedding permission on some of the things, but because they're on my site, it will link back to it through WordPress, and I don't have to make him put pictures in there. So it's kind of handy. But what I do is basically, as I get ideas, I make a little mini post, and I will save in my draft folder these posts of write tip ideas. It may just be a title, or it may be a title and a few notes about what I want to say. And until I get inspired on that idea, I won't write the post, but I'll go back and write it. But then I end up having some posts written in advance, and so I can schedule my post. And I didn't do it this week, and I'm probably going to really be hassling to get a post out by Monday. I might not. It might be that the right post this week is going to be Thursday, and this week's post might be a conquest report or something, which is more off the cuff. But I normally do that, and I schedule those, and I do the same thing with the posts I'm doing for other people. So I keep them on a schedule, and I have a little spreadsheet that I organize things on too, because I have to keep track of what I've sent it to and follow up with all the people.
You kind of keep an editorial calendar of sorts. Yeah, well,
And an Outlook calendar, as well as Outlook folders for the different things that I'm doing, so I can keep track of them. I'm also doing a series for AF's Wolf from Sams.Publishing, which is a fantasy science fiction magazine, where I'm interviewing people about short story writing, and I just interviewed Grandmaster James Gunn for the... That's going to be in the July issue. The June issue is Jack McDevitt. I did an interview with him,
great.
And that hasn't come out yet. It comes out June 15th. So, and those are actually the first time I've gotten paid to do these, so that was kind of a nice little bonus.
People aren't seeing me shake my head just because I'm still in amazement at all the contribution here. So,
well, I'm sitting here reading it off, going, "Holy crap! How do I do all this stuff?" See, I don't see it from the outside, but you know.
You're in the midst of it. You're just running through the jungle. You're not even thinking about it. But we're watching it from the outside, sitting here thinking, "Holy crap! How's he do all this stuff?"
As a writer, I've been feeling all this pressure because when I was writing Worker Prince, I got routinely 3K a day. Now I struggle to get 1,800 a day. No wonder my word count's dropped. I'm writing more than 3K a day. I'm writing all this other stuff. But you know, and I know when my best times of day to write are too. My best time for me tends to be between, as early in the morning as I get up, whenever it happens to be. It used to be I get up at 6 or 7. These days I tend to be up reading till about 2, so I don't usually get up till about 9. But that until 1 o'clock is my best writing time. Now, my best editing time is after I've had lunch and maybe walked the dogs. I used to take them on a 1-mile walk. or had a nap, and then I edit from like 2 to 5 in the afternoon. And then sometimes I get a spurt of writing at night between 7 and 9 that's really good. And obviously if I get another full-time job, I'm probably going to have to really do more of the night writing, which I'll adjust to. I used to write from as soon as I got home from work for a couple hours and spend time with the wife and then come back and write before I went to bed for a couple hours. And that's how I got most of the worker prints and stuff. And sometimes I'd wake up in the middle of the night and I'd start editing or something for a while because I couldn't go back to sleep and then get tired enough and go back to bed, you know? So knowing when your productive times are and balancing is part of the discipline. My thing about discipline, when I was going to college, or actually when I was getting my master's degree, I was doing 30 hours of classes and 35 hours a week work. So the only way that I was going to survive that and get decent grades, I figured out, was to actually make a time map for my week. I actually mapped out on a piece of paper every hour of every day of the week and started filling it in. These are the set times of classes. These are the regular days that I work, and my schedule might vary, but these are typical times. And I set it up so I could update it on my computer and print it out every week. And then I'd block in time to study. I'd block in time to read. If there was a TV show I really wanted to watch or something, I'd block in time for that. I'd block in some free time. And I'd block in sleep time. I blocked in literally.
You created a budget, if you will, for time.
I called it a time budget. That's what I called it. And I have time for meals and the whole deal. And by sticking to that, it really helped me. Because I found that if you have bad discipline in one area of your life, it seeps over into other areas. So when I start getting really lazy in one area, which is why I'm back on a diet and I'm starting to get back into exercise, because it affects my writing too, because I get really lazy. And part of it is because of what I've been through. I've been dealing with depression too. And depression, just there's days you don't want to get out of bed. Right. And you have to force yourself to do it. So, you know, that's one of those things that I, you know, have had to learn about discipline. And I always tell people when I talk about discipline, that's a really important thing, to figure out where your buttons are and what your things are and control it. Some people have to turn their Wi-Fi off on the right because they can't do it. I usually do pretty well. I get distracted from time to time, but I can do pretty well not worrying about it. But I usually have to leave the TV off. Although, as I told, I was talking to Carol, Glenn Cook's wife, and Brent the other day, and I told him, there are times when literally I sit down at the TV because I'm done writing and I can't think of anything more. And all of a sudden I get the idea. And an hour later I realize, oh, I've just missed the entire TV show I was trying to watch because I've been sitting here writing on my notepad that I left lying around. And I got to go type this up. So I'll shut it off and go retype it. There was a couple TV shows that kept happening to me with, and I'm like, dang, I'm never going to finish the show. I'm never going to watch the show, you know.
But inspiration struck, and it took hold. Well, we talked about the process quite a bit. The other part of the acknowledgments, too, were the names, and a vast array of names and all different levels and roles within the industry. So the other question I wanted to ask you, jumping off from the acknowledgments, and because you've been you've been working this process over the last couple of years and going through this, is, you know, the best way for, and it's even such something we touched on with Glenn, you know, when we talked to Glenn, is what's the best way for an aspiring writer to establish a relationship with professionals, as well as others in the industry? Because they're all walks of professionals, and solicit some assistance a writer needs to improve his or her craft, because you've obviously done that. Right.
Well,
what did you see work?
Look,
what worked in?
I'm not at the point where Mike Resnick is my beta reader, if that's what you're suggesting.
No,
so I'm not.
No.
I'm clarifying that so people understand.
Stand. Yeah.
I'm not even at the point where I'm his beta reader. So yeah. But other than having edited him once for an anthology, but the reality of it is, I don't get it right all the time. I've actually had some people just got. I heard some things from somebody that there were some people that said that I did too much. But the problem with it is, especially with marketing, some people really hate doing marketing, and some people are old school, and they're like, I have a publisher, I don't have to do marketing, they've never had to do marketing, and so they don't know how to do marketing, and so they think anything is too much.
Yeah.
So one man's too much is another man's just right. So you have to kind of take that with a grain of salt, but you do tend to look at, I always look at when I get, like I just, like I do with the reviews, I'm going to say, okay, what could I be doing differently that would maybe make that less of a problem for people, because I don't want to do that. I'm the same way when I talk about my religion. I don't want to be preaching at somebody. Now, if somebody asks me a question, I can have a conversation with them about what I believe, but I'm not trying to convince them of my point of view or evangelize them. I'm just having a conversation like we're having right now. And so I try to be very careful with that. And I think that for me, the way you build networks is just like you do it in anything else in life. Okay, no matter how famous it is, Robert Silverberg's a human being. Okay, Robert Sawyer, I struggle. I was like, I don't know what to call you. He goes, call me Rob, please. Just call me Rocco. Okay. I said, because I'll call you Mr. Sawyer if you want, you know. he's like, no, you can call me Rob, you know. They're just human beings. And yeah, we do get starstruck from time to time, and that's okay. But the truth is they were there once, too. There was Silverberg and Glenn was talking about, you know, how starstruck he was when he met some of these people. It's like, holy crap. And I know Gardner was talking about it, too, you know. When you meet these, like, I can't believe I just met, you know, I'm hanging out with Stephen King. I'm hanging out with so-and-so. It's hard to believe. You know, but the reality is they are just people. So what you have to do is remember that the way you build relationships with people is not to talk about yourself. It's to ask them questions about them. And if you know something about their work and can compliment them on their work, even if you haven't read it, you know, hey, Brent, I heard really good things about your novel, which actually I've heard some good things about your writing. Cool. That's going to go over better than me coming over and say, hey, my book's on the Barnes & Noble Year's Best List. How you doing? Nice to meet you. And be like, okay. I mean, I'm not shy telling people that it's on that list when it's appropriate to talk about the book, because that's a kudos thing. It's kind of, it's not everybody gets their debut novel on that list. It's one of the only debut novels. There was a few debut novels, but it, you know, I mean, I was lucky. But
what I call a BDD,
yeah,
a big dang deal.
Yeah,
so it's one of those things, right, where you need
it. It is,
but you don't run around
don't put it on a T-shirt with flashing lights and walk around and you know, just call me Barnes & Noble Year's Best. Thank you very much. That's, you know. You have to be really subtle about it. And I think when you're doing cons, my general rule with pros is, unless they ask me, I might introduce myself and say I'm a writer, but I don't tell them a whole lot about what I do unless they ask me. Right. But I will ask them about their stuff. And that's the same thing. And, you know, one of the ways I get around it, of course, is when I'm doing chat, I'm officially interviewing them, so I have a right to ask them all kinds of stuff. But the other thing that I do as far as being organized, you know, I don't always tell everybody this, but you know, I worked in television and film for a while. And when I'm doing the chat, they get the questions in advance. I have them all prepared. They're all 140 characters with the hashtag. I send it to them in advance, and I tell them if they want to write up their tweets in advance, because they're going to get a lot of questions from people who are not me that they're going to have to ad lib, and it really slows things down. But the main reason I do it is it makes people comfortable. And the more comfortable they are, the better interview, the better, more fun they're going to have. And that's what I want, is create a fun environment. And it's worked, because I have a lot of people that are just like, oh, man, I had such a blast doing the show. Really enjoyed it. Thank you so much, you know. And it's a chance for regular, ordinary fans to talk to these people. But the best way to build those relationships is just to follow them on Twitter, make appropriate comments. Don't get in political arguments with them. Don't get in these religious arguments with them. Don't slam them for things. Be very sensitive about it. I mean, you know, there's a time and a place to do reviews, and there's a way to use tact, and we all have to use discretion. So I think a lot of people have not learned discretion anymore. I mean, there's things you don't say because you know you're going to offend somebody, and it's not worth doing it except for in private. You still have to do that when you're making relationships too. And I think it's all of those basic skills, and then you basically just stay in touch with people. Don't push them too hard on, you know, trying to get personal contact. Don't ask somebody to read your work. I mean, I've had people offer to read my work, and I've let them read my work, and that's been great.
If they offer.
Well, the only time I did that, I broke that rule, was somebody asked me to do a blurb from it, and I said, I have this story I'm really struggling with. Is there any chance that you think you could find time to read it at some point? And I said, I won't be offended if you say no, but I just thought, you know. And they said, sure, absolutely. You know, you're going to read my novel and blurb it, or you're going to do whatever. I'll do that for you, you know. And she said, but I'm gonna, you know, I'll be honest with you about it. And I said, no problem. And I'm not going to ask you all the time to be my beta reader. I just, you know. So once you have enough of a relationship with somebody, you can do that. But I just think you have to remember, these people get demands on their time all the time. They get everybody coming up to them. It's just kind of like when you read self-published stuff on Amazon. Sometimes you're getting crap, and you're like, oh, my God, I wasted my money. Why did I get this? And sometimes you're actually getting something really good. Well, they have those people coming at them all day. And unfortunately, probably 90% of what they get is people who have a little bit more ego than they deserve, whose writing isn't up to par, than the people who are actually really talented and are humble. And that's the way, ironically, personalities tend to be. Yeah. So, I mean, the people who are the most talented are probably going to just blow everybody away, like, my writing is such crap. Oh, my God, my writing's like, I might as well have written it on a piece of toilet paper, because that's all it's worth, you know? And then you read it, and you're like, oh, my God, I should quit writing, because this person just... I mean, there's people like that talk about it. And I think, so you just remember that these people are getting demands all day long. Their publishers ask them to read books for them. Their colleagues ask them to blurb books for them. And they don't have only so much time in the day. They have to write, too. I think if you're respectful, that's the best way to build relationships.
You're respectful. That's good. And the other thing you mentioned, too, is if you get involved in something like what we're involved in. So,
sure.
You know, with the blogs, with the interviews, the podcast. You mentioned preparing the questions in advance to make them comfortable. But it's also what I took out of that, too, is if you want to be treated like a pro, act like a pro.
Yeah. You know what? Learn what a pro is and act like a pro. That's really true. That is good advice. The other thing is, don't just think that you have to start some big Twitter show or some big podcast. That's not what he's saying. Truthfully, there are a lot of people that want to get more publicity for their books, and they love to get the opportunity to do interviews on your blog. You can get a hold of these authors and set up an interview with them by email and just do it on the blog and build relationships with people like that. And I encourage you to do it. Just, you know, try to be respectful. And I would say, even if you're a big fan, the likelihood that the big names like Stephen King are going to be the first one you have that contact with is pretty small. Yeah. You kind of got to be realistic about where you start. But a lot of them really do make themselves available. So,
okay. Well, one thing, which is great advice, I mean, that's that model around, because I think a lot of people are looking to do that now. More and more people are looking to start the blogs, and we're seeing the And that's something I talked to Steve Miller about, was the proliferation of the fanzine-type blogs and the mm-hmm. blog reviews. So good, excellent advice around how to approach the authors. And I knew, based on where you've been the last couple of years, you'd be able to give some thoughtful input into that. Well, we haven't talked about Space Battles.
Oh.
The anthology you edited. So I want to make sure that it was recently released. So I want you to tell us how you got involved as the editor and what the book's about, what the anthology's
about.
Space
Battles is an anthology in a series called Full Throttle Space Tales from Flying Pen Press out of Denver. And they're basically, they all have themes. They had Space Pirates was like one of them. Then they had Space Grunts. And they had Space Tramps and Space Sirens and these different themes. And I got involved because I was actually trying to pitch an anthology that it looks like I'm going to get to do about first encounters told from other world perspectives. What I mean is, what would it look like? We all know there's tons of Western point of view stories about, you know, Americans, British, or whoever having first encounters. What would it look like for the Brazilians? What if the Amazon Indians had a first encounter? How would that culture clash with the aliens' culture?
Sure.
How would the aliens regard it, or how would they regard the aliens? There's a lot of writers in the what we used to call the third world, the developing world, the other world is what I like to call it, because those other terms tend to be offensive for them, because it almost downgrades them to a level that they're not as important a part of the world as we are, which really isn't true. The reality is, the other world perspective, there's a lot of really good writers writing science fiction, but they don't get a lot of exposure. So I wanted to get some people like Mike Resnick, who's written stories in Africa and has a very good sense of the African point of view, and mix them in with some of these writers that people haven't heard of and give them an opportunity. But nobody would take me seriously because I'd never edited anything like an anthology. I'd done some private book editing, but I hadn't done enough at that point that anybody would take me seriously. So I started pitching that idea to Flying Pen Press, and Flying Pen Press couldn't do it the way I wanted to do it, with pro rates and different things, because they're a small press. But he offered me the opportunity to edit one of the anthologies, and I pitched him several ideas, and Space Battles was the one we ended up doing. So the first thing I did was recruit Mike Resnick to be my headliner and start getting some people going, and it kind of went from there. And now because I've proven myself, having done an anthology that's been well received, I have an opportunity now to pitch some of these other anthologies. So I'm getting a chance to go back and look at my world encounters and different things. So,
in addition to book three of the Dobby Rhee saga, is that what you're working on?
I've got that, and I've got my epic fantasy series, which is the Dawning Age trilogy, which is actually kind of a mix of epic fantasy, steampunk, and some other things, because it takes place it's not on Earth, it's on another planet and another world that kind of has a medieval feel to it, but they had an age of faith and magic, where faith and magic were the dominating forces. But then they had some evil magic users, the wizards, that kind of caused a bunch of wars. So now magic and anything associated with it has been outlawed, and along with that, they've outlawed faith, because faith was the effect that faith had for people religiously was that the more faith you had, the stronger your magic was. Whether it was religious or otherwise, but religious was part of it. Now they're in the dawning age. It's an age of science and reason. Mm-hmm. But there are still people born who have the gift of faith and magic. The governors have controlled all the technology. You don't have airships in the part of the Outer Lands where all the magic users were focused and where they grew up. The little people, who are like not human little people, they're called dwarves, but they're little people, much like Tyrion is in Song of Ice and Fire, they were good friends with the magic users. They've been outcast too, because people are afraid of them. So there's all these things going on, but see, now these people are starting to come back and say, wait a minute, why are we living in the medieval age, while you've got airships that you can transport around to, big steamships, and all this technology. So it's interesting because I've actually got two worlds. I've got a more high-tech world, and I've got a low-tech world, and they're coming together, and there's kind of some interesting things going on.
The clash between those two worlds and what will happen, particularly if magic and religion were viewed as taboo, you know, taboo or you're outcast.
That's what I'm working on now. And so that's a scoop because that's the most I've told anybody about it. But that book one will hopefully be done in the third draft of that. The second full draft. I did some polished drafts on some parts, playing with it, trying to get the world building down. And now I'm really going back through. Cat Ramble was gracious enough to read some chapters for me and give me some tidbits on some specific things that I wanted to work on. And so I'm kind of going back and doing it. And anyway, I'm hoping to finish that in June and then get back on the third Davy Reed book, which is the Exodus. And then anthologies are things I edit on the side. I also do some editing for Grail Quest books, which is a small press, and then for individual authors when they ask me to. So,
well, when you're giving a scoop like that, and I know that you've ended book two of the Davy Reed on the Who Killed JR kind of thing, I think that's a good place to stop. We're going to stop on the scoop here.
All right.
So, but Brian, and let you get back to selling some books. So, Brian, I've truly enjoyed speaking with you today. And I know I've gotten a chance to speak with him all through the con. I enjoy speaking with him any moment I get, quite frankly. But
and I just want, and he will testify, I don't blab on this much when we're having a normal conversation. So I feel like I've talked way too much in this interview. But
no, I seem to recall, well, for those of us that are closet Smash watchers, we Brian, Rich Horton, and I come to find out there's sci-fi geeks out there that are watching Broadway TV shows too, which was quite interesting. Yeah, we all got equal time,
and we don't fit the stereotype, so we like Broadway musicals anyway. You know? Yeah.
We all got equal time, I think, on that panel. So Brian, I've really truly enjoyed speaking with you today. Thanks for taking the time.
It's a real pleasure, and it's a privilege to be a part of Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. Continue to listen, everybody. Read those books, whatever they are. I mean, there's some great stuff going on. Thank you for the opportunity.
Please visit AdventuresInSciFiPublishing.com for show notes, videos, reviews, and more, and email us at AdventuresInSciFiPublishing@gmail.com. Some sound effects from the Free Sounds Project. Music by Asymmetry, found at MusicAlley.com. No authors were permanently damaged in the making of this podcast.